President Trump's tweets claiming ISIS is defeated and the 2,000 or so American troops in Syria are coming home are still reverberating. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham on CNN today with a comparison to domestic politics.
This is just a disaster in the making. Taking our forces out of Syria would be akin to tearing down the wall along the southern border. We're more exposed with withdrawing our forces because they're a virtual wall to protect us against the rise of ISIS and radical Islam.
And this morning on NPR's Morning Edition, Admiral James Stavridis said while the U.S. troop number, again a little over 2,000, is small, withdrawal would be a Christmas present to Russia's Vladimir Putin, who's been backing the Assad regime. But Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says he supports removing the troops. And on CNN, he rejected fears that violence will surge, as it did when President Obama pulled troops out of Iraq.
I don't think it's fair to say that, well, the same thing's going to happen in Syria that happened in Iraq, because what's happening in Syria right now, even as we are there, is totally unacceptable. This strategy of putting 2,000 troops has frankly not worked. It has not stopped the carnage.
But what about the Kurds, the U.S. allies who've been fighting ISIS in Syria? They're backed by the U.S. troops. And by the way, two of those troops have been killed in Syria. Dr. Najmuddin Karim is president and founder of the Washington Kurdish Institute. He's in Kurdish Erbil in Iraq. Doctor, your reaction to withdrawal?
You know, the announcement was shocking to thousands of brave men and women who worked with the U.S. special forces and coalition forces to defeat ISIS and liberate the people from about 35% of Syrian land. They paid with their lives, thousands of injured and killed in these battles. Now, all of a sudden, they are being left without any warning. And what is really surprising about this, this comes with a tweet. President Trump's policy is schizophrenic. On one side, he's trying to contain Iran, and on the other side, he is allowing Iran with Russia and the Syrian regime to control all of Syria. And actually, he has allowed the Iranians to be at the doorstep of Israel. And actually, for those who say that the troops should come back, the mission is not finished. Why were they sent there to begin with if this was the policy to abandon your friends? And then this tweet actually is going to unleash the jihadist terrorists supported by Turkey to invade northern and northeast Syria against the same people who have fought with the brave U.S. Forces, the special forces, and U.S. coalition from other countries such as Britain and France.
Just last week, a spokesperson for the Coalition Against the Islamic State estimated that ISIS, the Islamic State, still had 2,000 to 2,500 fighters just in one area in Syria. There might be 20 to 30,000 across Syria and Iraq, still carrying out an estimated 75 attacks a day. That's according to a researcher at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. So pretty much the consensus is that while ISIS has certainly been largely defeated with the help of the Kurds, they are by no means gone. Does it feel like an abandonment to you? It feels to many people like it's another abandonment of the Kurds.
It is an abandonment. And this is the same thing that happened after 2011 when the troops withdrew from Iraq and we saw that Al-Qaeda reconstituted. Then they all became ISIS and established the caliphate in Syria and Iraq. And the same thing will happen, I'm sure. And we know after emboldening the Iranians and the Shia militias to attack the Kurdish forces in Iraqi Kurdistan, ISIS has reemerged in Kirkuk, in other places, Diyala and Salahuddin provinces, and in western Iraq. So ISIS is not gone by any means.
But, Doctor, as you well know, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish forces in Syria, are an offshoot of the militia, the YPG, that's allied with a Turkish-Kurdish separatist group, the PKK. Turkey, of course, wants them wiped out, has been furious about the Kurdish forces on the Turkish border in Syria. Do you worry that this is an alliance between Turkey and the U.S. that will mean the Turks are now going to attack the Kurds?
This is really not the issue. I think President Trump gave in. I think he gave in because he's facing a lot of issues domestically, legally, and Turkey has become an authoritarian state. Turkey imprisons more journalists than any other country in the world, and they are the ones who are crying about Khashoggi. Actually, they probably are happy that Khashoggi was killed so they can get something out of it. The U.S. has double standards about these things. It looks like President Trump has not seen an authoritarian figure that he didn't like, actually.
But, Doctor, what do you say to Senator Chris Murphy, for instance, the Democrat from Connecticut, who said it was a half-hearted U.S. military commitment, just enough to increase the fighting but not enough to do anything about it? It was a quagmire.
It wasn't a quagmire. How many Americans were killed in Syria? It was the Kurdish forces that were getting killed and wounded and fighting and doing this. And I think the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor probably know the situation day to day and what these people have been able to do and accomplish more than the others.
That's Dr. Najmuddin Karim, president and founder of the Washington Kurdish Institute. We reached him in Erbil, the Kurdish territory in Iraq. Dr. Karim, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert.
Today in Washington, the Justice Department indicted two Chinese nationals accused of hacking and stealing trade secrets from U.S. federal agencies and corporations. The U.S. Navy and NASA are on the list of those targeted. Here's Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein speaking to reporters.
Faced with the detailed factual allegations today and the corroborating statements, not just from the United States, but from other victimized nations, China will find it difficult to pretend that it is not responsible for these actions.
This is a further escalation of tensions between the U.S. and China. Canada is involved as well. A third Canadian citizen has been detained in China in just over a week since the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, chief financial officer of the Chinese technology giant Huawei. That arrest happened in Vancouver. Let's bring in Evan Dyer, senior reporter with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Ottawa. Evan, who are the three Canadian citizens who've been detained in China and what are they accused of?
Well, I think that there's really a distinction between the first two to be picked up and the most recent or third detainee. The first two clearly appear to be reprisals for the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. One of them, Michael Kovrig, is a former Canadian diplomat. Actually, he's only on leave from Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs and probably will again have diplomatic immunity at some point in the future. But he had gone to work for an NGO, lost his immunity, and the Chinese picked him up and brought national security charges against him. The second one is a businessman, Michael Spavor, who actually is the guy who brought Dennis Rodman to North Korea. And he lives in Dandong near the North Korean border, and he's arranged a number of tours into North Korea. He actually knows Kim Jong-un personally. And obviously as somebody who would be high on any intelligence agency's list of people to observe, and they seem to have picked him up as well in retaliation, and he's also facing national security charges. But the third one, who's a teacher from Alberta, a woman called Sarah McIver, does not seem to be related, and both governments are making a distinction between her case, which is simply really about not having the right work visa, and the much more serious charges brought against the other two. It looks like she'll get consular access fairly easily, unlike the other two. And neither government China, of course, is officially denying that all of them are retaliation. But the governments are making an extra point about Sarah McIver that she doesn't seem to be caught up in the same dispute.
The interesting thing about this is you and I have talked before about the strained relationship between the Trump administration and the Trudeau administration in Canada. It's surprising that Canada would have put itself at risk like this in the first place to arrest Meng Wanzhou to help American prosecutors.
It isn't surprising when you look at the historical relationship between the two countries and the legal relationship between the two countries. The current tension between the Trump administration and the Trudeau government is a new development in U.S.-Canadian affairs. We've had an extradition treaty for decades, and hundreds of people have been sent in both directions under that extradition treaty, which operates independently of the political system. It's a simple warrant that shows up here at a prosecutor's office and is then enforced. So Canada simply went through the motions with that extradition warrant as it would with any other. There was no political interference, we're told, although the Prime Minister of Canada did get advance warning that this arrest was going to be made. The problem, of course, is that at the same time as Canada is putting its own citizens at risk to help the U.S. with this national security case, Canada has been labeled a national security threat by the Trump administration, which is something that caused a lot of outrage in this country. It's felt to be a very flimsy pretext.
You're talking about the steel and aluminum tariffs, right? They called it a national security risk.
Exactly. So this is a pretext for putting tariffs on Canadian metals. And Canada has argued, wait a minute, the very metals that you're calling a national security threat are used to make American Abrams tanks. They're used in American fighter jets. How can Canada, which is a member of NORAD, not to mention NATO, be a national security threat? So there's that tension. And at the same time, you know, the Trudeau government has come under a lot of direct criticism and even insults from the Trump administration. So you may recall President Trump accusing Trudeau of being dishonest and weak and so on. Well, at the same time, he's praised President Xi of China to the skies on numerous occasions. So there is an irony here that Canada has been asked to make these sacrifices, but Canada is doing what it has always done, which is following the treaty.
That is Evan Dyer, senior reporter with the CBC in Ottawa. Evan, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Have you ever tried a post-divorce vacation with your ex and both of your new partners? How'd that go? Well, did anyone get shot by a bow and arrow? That's what happens when Claire and Matt, 2 years separated, decide to spend Christmas together at the Happy Forest Holiday Park for the sake of their daughter, Scarlett. Matt brings his skateboard and his new girlfriend, Alex. Matt's ex, Claire, brings her running-addicted boyfriend, Patrick. Scarlett, age 7, brings her very opinionated imaginary friend, Posey, a 6-foot-tall rabbit. What could go wrong? Well, as the grown-ups keep saying, we're all adults. The Adults is a new novel. It's part whodunit, part hilarious Noel Coward bedroom comedy, or any funny movie with Hugh Grant in it. The Lancaster Evening Post in Britain, where the book is set, calls it 2018's funniest domestic drama. It's also part poker game, because author Caroline Hulse is a professional poker player. She's won about $30,000, but she's applied her observations at the table to her characters, and she joins us from the BBC's Manchester studios. Welcome, Caroline.
Hi.
Okay, full disclosure, producer Karen said to me, well, we have to say to her, no sane person would ever attempt a vacation with an ex and their new spouses. And I said, well, define sane, because I do have a treasured friendship with an ex and his wife. We do vacation together every year. Last night I called him and said, well, at least no one got shot with a bow and arrow. is this something you know about?
So I read something about it a long time ago, which was one of the things that inspired the book of a couple doing it. And I just thought, I was really impressed, but I just thought there's a real opportunity there for things to go wrong. And as someone who writes books, conflict really helps books drive them forward, I think, as page turners. So it just stuck with me as an idea, because I don't think I'm grown up enough to do that.
The newer partners have their doubts about this. And then they watch as the couple that had separated, Matt and Claire, gets along way too well, you know, and soon you put in a couple glasses of wine and it just explodes. But you say conflict drives books. Mm. This is largely emotional, internal conflict, and that's what drives poker. In reading this, it did feel like a poker game, you know, who's going to make the next move? Who's bluffing? Who's lying?
Yeah, I think if you spend a lot of time playing poker, sitting around the table with people, you just spend a lot of time observing people in competitive environments where they're feeling quite emotional and not necessarily at their best, because it's not just money, it's ego. It's a lot of things can be bound up in that poker game.
It's not knowing where you stand.
Exactly. That's a really key part. It's also feeling like other people might be taking advantage of you, which often doesn't bring the best out of people. So I think poker has definitely been a really big influence on my writing, even though I don't actually write about poker.
No, you don't. But, in a way, it seems to us that you do. And I just found it interesting that there are many other professional female poker players who have taken the literature. Gail Massett wrote The Girl from Blind River. Helen Ellis wrote a collection of short stories, American Housewife. MJ Hyland, who was a Man book finalist, Carry Me Down. And they talk about, you know, poker players have to listen and observe, so do writers. Talk about some of the other ways that you picked up human behavior in a poker game and put it in your characters.
I think internal conflict is a big one. So I think there's a lots of times in poker where you know what the sensible thing is to do, but you don't actually want to do it. And I think there's lots of situations like that in life as well. But, you know, in poker, often you know the right thing is to fold that hand, but you've got too much money invested, or you really, really need that money, or you really want to beat that person. So you end up making suboptimal decisions. And I think that's a really key part of the game. And I think in the book, there's a few examples. I don't want to do too many spoilers, but where people make bad decisions purely because they want things to be a certain way.
Because they've gone, what is the phrase, on tilt?
Yeah, they've gone on tilt. Oh, well done. Yeah, so that's a poker term. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Not only through your writing.
So that is a phrase which is, there are obviously optimal, rational decisions to make in poker. But where you go on tilt, that's a phrase that poker players use for if someone's making decisions based on emotions. So that could be that you've had several bad beats in a row where you were meant to win a hand, but something really freaky happened. So, you know, someone hit their 1% card to beat you. And then you can end up playing a little bit scared, or you can play different kinds of tilt. So the one that I have to watch is gender tilt, because I'm female, and most of the people I play with are men. And sometimes I have to make sure that I don't think I'm being bullied because mm-hmm. of my gender, because you can make really bad decisions right. on that basis.
Well, some of these other writers talk about how male poker players do try to bully them or mansplain them or stare at their body parts to try to intimidate them. Mm. Or react badly when things don't go well. And you have the character Matt, who's supposed to be this carefree skateboarding 30-something, fall apart at a certain point. And that came from a poker observation.
Yeah, definitely. I think in poker, you can see where people are starting to turn. When people lose, they're often furious, and then they're often looking to blame someone else. Patrick does it as well. But I think definitely you can see that shift where people aren't making the best decisions anymore. And as a poker player, you're meant to take advantage of that. That's when you're meant to swoop in.
Right. And this is where it, again, starts to get back to our characters on this ridiculous weekend at this ridiculous resort with elves running around and everything, this Christmas resort. You say how you can feel as a poker player. You get a feeling of, hey, I deserve my luck to change.
Exactly.
I deserve this. And then you have Alex, who's the girlfriend of Matt, the ex of Claire, who starts to have that feeling of, I deserve more. I think I'm feeling left out here. Did he get her the same perfume he got me? And before you know it, she is full on tilt.
Absolutely. She's a very rational person who thinks she's still behaving rationally. But I think if you trace her behavior over the book, there are definite turning points where she could have made better decisions.
Yeah. MJ Hyland writes about glancing under the table on a pretense of dropping something to see if anybody's jiggling their legs, a giveaway that, you know, they're calm above, but a wreck below. You have Patrick, the boyfriend of Claire, jiggling his legs at the table.
Yeah, you do. You look in poker. You look for all those kind of things. You know, the movements of people's mouths and the micro expressions, that kind of thing.
Look, back to the book. So much fun. It opens with the transcript of an emergency call placed from the Happy Forest Holiday Park because someone's been shot with a bow and arrow. I shouldn't laugh because it's a serious wound. So we know right in the beginning that this happens at the end. And then along the way, we see more transcripts from police interviews with people who might have been on the scene of this bow and arrow near fatality. Why did you do that? Put the ending at the beginning?
I think I wanted it to be an exploration of how you got somewhere. So I wanted people to know this was a disastrous holiday and then to backtrack how these reasonable people, and I still do think highly of these people, you know, ended up in this situation. So I was really keen that there was something at the start so that you knew it was going to go horribly wrong, even though probably you got that inkling before it started.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, too, because it, again, felt to me, and maybe I'm reading too much here knowing that you play poker, but it felt to me like dealing us a card at a time. You know, we're going to get a card at a time until we have a full hand at the end.
I like that.
I have to ask about Posey, the
yes.
really, as we said, opinionated, very tall, with very large ears, imaginary rabbit of this 7-year-old. What a delightful character. What is he doing there?
The child feels quite a few negative emotions, and she seems to have developed this rabbit to manage those emotions through, or maybe to say the things that the child doesn't want to say out loud. So what you end up with is this quite passive-aggressive rabbit who says what he does and doesn't want to do in quite strong terms, and that actually causes quite a lot of problems for the human characters. It was a risk putting that rabbit in the book, an imaginary character in a you know, it's an adult book. Everyone seems to really like the rabbit. And I have to say, it was my favourite bit to write. It's quite satisfying writing a very passive-aggressive character that can do exactly what they want,
well,
whenever they want, with
right.
no implications.
Which, by the way, he is the sort of the thing that the child, who wants to express thoughts about her parents splitting up and really can't, or the adults can express. They're all trying to keep it together and be adult. I mean, he can be a rabbit, but they're all trying to be adults, and the whole thing devolves. At the end, they're all 7.
Yeah, that's a good analysis.
what else are you saying? What did you discover? And, you know, you started off by saying, well, this is impossible. Who can do this kind of thing? You say you end up liking these characters. And as you said, a lot of people managed to create friendships out of the ashes of relationships. I don't want to give away the ending, but despite someone being shot, this may be where this is headed. What are you saying about relationships and possibilities for friendships and about honesty? Because they discover throughout that a lot of people who loved each other lied to each other. And then there's a whopper of a lie at the end.
I think that there are a lot of blended families increasingly out there, and people trying to find a way of making things work for them. And just because a relationship ends, you know, if you've got a child together, you are together for life in some ways. So I think it is very admirable and very mature for people to find a way of trying to make this work for them. I think because of the conflict opportunities, and because I'm a sneaky author who's just trying to find interesting scenarios, you know, I use that as an opportunity for conflict. But I say I don't know anyone who does it. It could be that it works very well for some people. And as I say, I read an article about people who found it very helpful.
Yeah. It also occurs to me that what they create at the end, there may be some falsehoods or, you know, about the way they're describing reality, but that's like poker.
Yeah, I think you can talk to several people about the same hand of poker and they'll tell you what was going on and they'll tell you a slightly different version of the story. And I think that's life. Mm-hmm. And I think we've all got our own versions of the stories. And I think depending on how well they stack up next to each other, yeah, that can make things easier or it can make things hard.
That's Caroline Hulse, professional poker player and now author of the debut novel, The Adults. Caroline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Caroline sent us some other advice for poker players. She says the long-term game in poker is a good mathematical grounding. Things like range analysis, estimating how your hand fares against your opponent's possible hand. But she said, look, in the end, whether at the poker table or the kitchen table on a weekend with blended family, try not to tilt.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped below 23,000 today for the first time since the fall of 2017. It's just a day after the Federal Reserve announced it would raise interest rates another quarter percentage point. That's its fourth increase of the year. Joining us now is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure podcast. Hi, Robin.
Sir, how are you?
Doing well, but what should investors and ordinary people who've got retirement accounts be thinking today? The S&P has fallen more than 9% this month.
Hello, volatility, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Yes, sir. I'm sorry that that had to pierce your ears, but this is not a pleasant thing to talk about. We're going to see a lot of relief rallies versus sell-offs of uncertainty.
Seems like more sell-offs these days, though, than
well,
relief rallies.
Well, we're also in the throes of a trade war with China. I mean, look, unemployment and inflation are low. Corrections are a fact of life. But increasingly, if you talk to executives and fund managers, you're starting to appreciate that there's new anxiety over a willingness to hire or to extend credit. So you're feeling more of that wait and see.
Well, and when you look at what the Fed did yesterday, and, you know, the Fed had been signaling that it was going to raise rates again this year for a long time. President Trump had been saying, no, 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 don't raise rates. The Fed is supposed to be an independent body. But then they did raise rates. And the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers tweeted today, the Fed is taking needless risks with the economy. Neither price nor financial stability required yesterday's actions. What are people saying today about what the Fed did and whether it is making the right decisions?
The purists are still saying that it has been a long time that we've kept this emergency low interest rate policy. I mean, we don't want to talk in absolute terms, but 5.25% was the interest rate level before the financial crisis. I mean, we're still at a fraction of that. But look, on the flip side, consumer credit is already feeling it, and it certainly harshes the buzz of your Christmas eggnog when you and your guests are talking about the market's pullback. So the question is this going to be a breather in a long market expansion or the beginning of an economic recession and a bear market maybe?
And recessions do happen. So, you know, eventually we're going to have to deal with one again. While we have you, Robin, let's talk a little bit about travel. Gatwick Airport, Britain's second largest, has been shut since yesterday because of drone sightings near planes. Today, EasyJet, the low-cost carrier there, said it canceled all flights. Now, we're talking a couple days before Christmas, to and from Gatwick today. So a total travel nightmare there. Here in the U.S., we've got a big storm coming in the East Coast tomorrow and starting, I guess, tonight. Rain and snow in the Northwest for the next few days. How bad are the delays going to be at airports, or what are you expecting with travel the next couple of days?
You cannot control Mother Nature. I've tried my whole life to no avail. But I think it doesn't help matters that our airlines in the United States, they're super consolidated right now. They're packed to the gills, overbooked. And maybe on the margins, Jeremy, they're complacent. The infrastructure at the airports, it's just not kept up. And there's no relief from the highways or Amtrak and cold comfort to visit your loved ones over FaceTime or Skype.
I guess it makes it easy for you to talk about the weather while you're sitting in 80-degree Miami at WLRN.
I know this is a hard life, but I'm expecting my family to fly in tonight, and they could be delayed significantly. Okay. So there's anxiety across the system.
All right. Well, I hope that they get there. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure podcast. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining us.
Merry Christmas to you,
Jeremy.
Merry
Christmas.
Take care.
We are in the throes of the holiday season, and while every family celebrates in their own way, some traditions are ever-present and downright odd when you stop to think about them. For instance, who is Santa Claus, and why do we expect him to come down the chimney with presents every year? For answers, let's bring in historians Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly. They're co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome. And Nathan, Christmas right around the corner. Let's start there. What are the origins of celebrating Christmas?
So Christmas is a holiday that we got around the 4th century when the church officially recognized December 25th as Christmas. And it's important to note that the date was not chosen because it was necessarily Jesus's birthday. We don't really know when that was, but actually was chosen to help crowd out what were pagan holidays competing for the attention of Roman subjects. And so what you have are the barren months of a time of year when things don't grow and there are difficulties in keeping people basically in charge of their bodily control. And so you need to have things that compete with fertility festivals and things.
Hold on,
are...
Nathan. They did marketing back then?
No. But they certainly tried to find ways to keep the spring fertile, if you know what I mean. So the winter months were the time of year when a lot of different pagan followers were thinking about, multiplying, and the church needed to find a way to crowd that out by creating a Christian holiday for that time of year.
Okay, so the church was okay with that, to have these pagan traditions alongside Christian worship?
Well, you got to remember that people weren't just flocking to become Christian. So how did Christianity spread across Western Europe in this case? Well, it spread by compromising. They did not come in and clear-cut all the traditions, in the case of the Christmas tree and the Yule log. They adapted them and Christianized them, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And what about Santa Claus? Where did he come from?
Well, Santa Claus is based on St. Nicholas, who was the patron saint of kids in old Europe. But the real St. Nicholas could be nice to kids, but he could be pretty mean if you didn't do the right thing.
If you're naughty.
If you're naughty, exactly. Right. And what we did in the United States, we kind of domesticated St. Nicholas and turned him into Santa Claus. A good example of doing that was the poem written by Clement Clark Moore. You probably know it, Jeremy. 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. What happened to St. Nicholas as he was turned into Santa Claus in this poem is, rather than having a scepter, he got a bag. And in that bag were gifts. And that became the real centerpiece. Santa Claus had a red nose. Now, to a lot of urban middle-class dwellers, red nose meant drunk. But rather than having an old drunk coming down your chimney, it turned out this was a nice man bringing gifts.
And was he always a bearded white guy?
Yes, he always was a bearded guy.
Nathan?
They kept that.
No. I have to part with my colleague on this one. The beautiful thing about Santa Claus and all of his many iterations, and this goes back to the very beginning when there are overlaps between, say, the Norse god Odin and his evergreen tree, right, and Santa Claus, through the Middle Ages. But, even in the United States, obviously we have ways in which Americans like to make things their own, and Santa Claus is certainly no exception. One of my favorite examples, in fact, is from the mid-1930s, where you have African Americans who are migrating from rural to urban America, oftentimes stopping at what are called, transient camps for people who are working in the agricultural sector under the Works Progress Administration during the New Deal. And one of these camps was basically celebrating a festival in Richmond, Virginia, and they rolled out a black Santa. these African-American kids booed the black Santa. They're like, Santa can't possibly be black. This is totally fake. And it was used by the black press as an example of how white traditions were effectively taking over African-American sensibilities. And this concern about children wound up animating a whole host of debates that ultimately helped to dismantle segregation. So Christmas still had its politics, and they were totally wrapped up in Santa's white beard.
Okay, well, there's the story of Christmas, at least what we're going to hear in a few minutes on Here and Now. But let's talk about some of the other big holidays this season. Kwanzaa. Nathan, it starts next week on December 26th. What is Kwanzaa's origin story?
Well, similarly, it's about, you know, folks trying to make part of the Christmas season their own. Kwanzaa was started in the 1960s when it was a hotbed time of black nationalist sentiment. Activist and thinker Maulana Karenga in 1966 celebrates the first Kwanzaa celebration, and it's meant to try to build a sense of community through principles like unity and self-determination, collective work and responsibility, even cooperative economics and creativity. And the seven principles of Kwanzaa are in part not there to replace Christmas, but to try to take some of the commercial aspects out of Christmas and also to challenge, again, some of the iconography that might not be fully representative of the diversity that is in the country at the time. And I've been to Kwanzaa celebrations. I've actually celebrated in my own home once or twice. And, you know, it is the kind of thing that helps you to slow down, even if you don't necessarily, you know, speak Swahili, for instance, which is how many of the principles are translated. It provides a different counterpoint to a holiday that can oftentimes be overshadowed by consumerism and the like.
Okay, and let's talk about Hanukkah, which is a huge holiday that just ended. How did it evolve in mainstream American culture?
Well, again, similarly, it coexists with Christmas. But again, I think it's important to recognize that even within the broader Jewish community around the world, Hanukkah is not, one would say, on par with Christmas in the way that it is, say, in the United States. It really is a kind of companion holiday to the Christmas season. And it's a way of folding Jewish Americans into the broader calendar and the social fabric. And of course, pop culture reflects this in things like, say, Hanukkah Harry on Saturday Night Live or other ways in which the dominant culture has to incorporate or account for Hanukkah's presence.
And Jeremy, I think you don't know this, but I think Nathan does. For a period in our family's history, we were celebrating Hanukkah, Christmas, and Kwanzaa, because I'm Jewish, my wife has Protestant heritage, and my kids are African American. So, boy, did they get a lot of gifts.
Well, that brings us to one big part of it that I want to know about, which is consumerism. At this point, the whole holiday season is all about making as much money as possible for so many retailers out there. When did that happen? Why did it become like that, Brian?
It happened earlier than you might guess. It really happened in the middle of the 19th century. And to understand this, you have to go back to where Nathan started. Those pagan traditions were all based on something that social scientists call an inversion. The way to explain that simply is people traded places for the day. Rich people pretended they were poor. Men pretended they were women. And try as they might, and the Puritans literally banned Christmas for 20 years in Massachusetts, try as they might, they couldn't completely eradicate that tradition of inversion, kind of a wild carnival-like holiday that continued all the way into the 19th century. But as America began to build big cities, as it industrialized, these working class people who were knocking on the doors of rich people demanding gifts, demanding to trade places for a day, became kind of scary. That's why old, jolly, friendly Saint Nick, Santa Claus coming down the chimney, needed to be turned into a friendly guy carrying gifts that could be distributed within families themselves rather than across social classes. And so that gift giving was very important for domesticating Christmas, for turning it into something that could be celebrated around the hearth of middle class homes in a much more orderly fashion than strangers knocking on your door in New York City.
With a red and white Starbucks cup that starts right after Halloween.
Well, this is exactly the thing, right? I mean, we still look to the so-called barren season for growth in the same way many of the ancient celebrants of Christmas did. And it's, again, one of these things that connects us all the way back. And, you know, the American economy is expected to have its sharpest growth during this time of year, right, when people are buying gifts and entertainment and paying for airplane tickets. So the idea is that we expect Christmas to kind of do that work to help us all prosper, even if we're not entirely sure of the ancient connections.
We didn't get to Festivus on this history of the holidays, but we'll do that next year. The feats of strength and the airing of grievances are very important traditions as well. Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Thanks so much.
Happy holidays.
If it's cold where you are, let's bring in a summer breeze with a look at baseball, and more specifically, what's being called an historic agreement reached by Major League Baseball yesterday with Cuba's Baseball Federation, which could really open up the pipeline of Cuban ballplayers coming to the U.S., although the Trump administration's hard line on the Cuban government may put the kibosh on the whole thing. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And remind us how Cuban players have come to the U.S. to play. So many of them, but I don't think people know historically how they've been able to play in the U.S.
Right. So since the Castro regime started cracking down and since it became hard to leave the island, players would essentially have to defect in the way that any other Cuban would have to defect, often at great risk and danger to themselves and their families. So there are specific stories about Livian Hernandez on a raft and Ray Ordonez jumping over a wall on an international team's competition. And recently, the L.A. Dodger, Yasiel Puig reportedly had to essentially negotiate with hostage takers who knew that he was worth so much money. And then it puts them in a position of sometimes never being able to contact their families or their families being threatened, and because this is seen as a way to intimidate the next player who was thinking of defecting. So yeah, this is, you know, it's a really terrible and fraught situation, unique in the world. And Cuban players have a long tradition and history in baseball. Last year, there were 25 Cubans in the major leagues. And for the last couple of years, with the opening of relations with Cuba under the Obama administration, the league has been trying to work out something more equitable for everyone.
But I just want to stay with this picture that you've painted, because we see them, you know, standing in the outfield, you know, scratching their butts or whatever they're doing out there. But to get there was incredible. And in fact, the Major League Baseball commissioner, Rob Manfred, said, you know, you talk about hostage taking and people on rafts trying to get off the island. They have been trafficked.
Yeah, this is human trafficking. And Major League Baseball says we have one reason to do this. And I'm going to put an asterisk in that, and I'll tell you in a second. But we had an opportunity to do something to stop human trafficking as relates to the people in our industry, so we're going to take that. Now, I should say that for the clubs, it's better for them, for the Major League clubs, it's more advantageous to have a system, a regulated system, rather than this, you know, slapdash, haphazard, often very dangerous way of getting players. So that's good, and that's also represents cost certainty. So, but that said, it is still an achievement in terms of making life better for these Cuban players who are going to find a way to come anyway.
Well, but here's a reaction from a senior Trump administration official, spoke to the Washington Post, and said the agreement would institutionalize a system by which a Cuban body, this is the Cuban Federation, garnishes the wages and hardworking athletes who simply seek to live and compete in a free society. And then later, parties seeking to benefit from business opportunities in Cuba are on notice that the administration will continue to take actions to support human rights and restrict the Cuban regime's ability to profit from U.S. business. So that was a direct, I think, arrow at Major League Baseball. But is that spokesperson right in this idea that, you know, before, as hard as it was, these players, if they got here, this was their income? Now it seems like they have to go through the Cuban Baseball Federation. You know, they're still under the thumb of the government.
Right. So I'll say two things. One is that it was an arrow, but I think the more apt metaphor is the rattled saber, because I'm not sure any policy will be associated with this, with the noise made by the administration, though it might. On the other hand, in a way, the administration is right if it objects, because money will be going into the pockets of the Cuban Baseball Federation, which doesn't conscript its players, but it's not a free market, and it's benefiting powerful Cuban elites who the U.S. government doesn't think that our citizens should be doing business with. Of course, the alternative would be to benefit human traffickers. So you either have a system where you treat the clubs that own the players as entities to do business with, just like a Korean club or a Japanese club right. would get some money for the services of a player, or you have a system where you call Cuba the same rogue regime we've been calling it for 20 years, but that brings with it its attendant problems that we've been talking about.
Look, we understand only players under contract to the Cuban Federation are covered by this agreement, and the Cuban Federation agreed to release all players 25 and older with at least 6 years of professional experience who want to go. Why would they do that? Yeah, I mean, yes, there might be some money coming in, but aren't they draining their own baseball system?
No, no, no. I would think that they are now looking at themselves as one of the premier minor leagues, and people who know baseball scouting think of the Cuban League as something akin to, you know, double or triple A. And if you're good there, you'll probably be, and history has shown, very good in America. So the Cuban League is now essentially like the Japanese League or the Korean League. It's also just like international soccer, or as they would call it, football. When one richer club, maybe from the English Premier League, draws from the Brazilian National League, that club who surrenders its player gets a fee.
Yeah.
Either we're a capitalist society or we're lawless and have a bunch of human trafficking that's allowed.
Yep, yep. It's a sense of pride, too. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports. Thank you.
You're welcome.